I don't know if I've actually just come out and said it quite yet. Maybe you've picked up on this. We're actually in the middle right now of a series where we've been looking at that dynamic relationship between the prophets and the kings. It's a relationship that gets a lot of attention in Scripture. It's a relationship that we trace back to Samuel. Samuel was a prophet, but he was more than a prophet. He was also a judge, the last judge of Israel, the best judge that they ever had. But at the end of his life, God took the judge and he turned him into the kingmaker. And Samuel was a little uncomfortable with this, understandably, because Samuel foresaw correctly that when you invest that much power and authority into a single individual, you raise the odds of that power being used in perverse and corrupt ways. What Samuel did not know was that God was going to use him as a prophet, and all the prophets who would come after him as a counterbalance in the new government that God was giving to his people. If you would have a king who would abuse power, then God was always going to have a prophet who would be willing to speak truth to power. And that's what we've been looking at. When you read through 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, all four books, by the way, we believe are written by the same author, you notice that the prophets get almost as much ink as the kings do. They feature quite prominently, but what you begin to discover is that not all of the prophets are the same. They have the same job. That is, every prophet's job is to speak on God's behalf to the king or to the people, but they don't always speak from the same place. When we begin with Samuel, well, he was the kingmaker. And so when Samuel speaks with Saul and you listen to the conversations, you get the sense that it's a conversation between equals, or that at times Samuel the prophet is speaking down to Saul and Saul's kind of looking up to him. That's not the sort of dynamic you get when you get to the prophet Nathan. Nathan is the prophet sent by God to call out King David for his sin with Bathsheba. Nathan is what we would call a court prophet. He's on the king's payroll, and his job is to be present in the king's court so that whenever the king wants to inquire of God, there's a prophet handy for the task. Very often, the kings wanted to know, if we go into battle, will God give us victory? And the prophet would say, yes, go, the Lord is with you. You'll have victory, or nope, the Lord is not in this, do not go. So Nathan, he does something very risky in calling out the king, especially given the nature of the sin, and yet we recognize that Nathan is still speaking from a position of influence and authority. He's a court prophet. He has the king's ear. We might say it this way. In our day, there's lots of pastors in this country, but only a very few are spiritual advisors to the president. There were many prophets in Israel, but not all of them got to speak in the court of the king. But can I tell you, this is not Elijah's story. He's the prophet we're going to look at this morning. Elijah does not speak from a place of influence or authority. No, he's not like Samuel. He's not like Nathan. Elijah, well, he's a prophet of the resistance. Elijah is a prophet of the northern kingdom of Israel. We saw last week the interaction between the prophet Ahijah and the soon-to-be king Jeroboam. In fact, their interactions form kind of the bookends of the whole story of Jeroboam. It begins when Ahijah comes to him and says, thus saith the Lord, I'm about to rip this kingdom in two. There will be a northern kingdom of Israel, there will be a southern kingdom of Judah, and to you, Jeroboam, I'm giving 10 tribes. You will be the king of the north, and I will establish for you a house just like the one I promised to give David, if only you will obey me wholeheartedly and follow and keep my ways. Your house will never fail. We know the problem here is that Jeroboam, he didn't trust the Lord, and so he didn't obey. And he sets the spiritual trajectory for the nation of Israel from the time of his reign until the time of the exile, when God finally spits the people out of the land and sent them off into exile. He led the people into more and more idolatry. He set the golden calves at Dan and at Bethel, and he forbid the people to go worship at Jerusalem, and he established high places all over, on all the hilltops. And that was the way the Israelites went until they went into exile. This is the context. So Elijah is the one who is supposed to speak for God in the midst of a nation that is deeply committed to their idolatry. Now, Jeroboam's sin did not just set the spiritual trajectory, it did that, but it also meant the ruin of his house. That was the last thing the prophet Ahijah said to him. He said, "You have not done in accordance with the word of the Lord, so instead of a sure house, your house shall fall." And fall it does. And what follows then is what we call the Omride dynasty. Omri was the commander of the army until the king was murdered. Then he moves on up. He becomes king. And what we know about the Omride dynasty, this period of history in Israel, this is the pinnacle of the northern kingdom's power and wealth and influence in the region. The kings in this dynasty, especially Ahab, were the most powerful the people of Israel would ever know. Now let me read you something about Ahab. This is 1 Kings chapter 16. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, the son of Omri, began to reign over Israel. And Ahab reigned over Israel in Samaria 22 years. And Ahab did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. And as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, he took for his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and he went and served Baal and worshipped him. He erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria. And Ahab made an Asherah. Ahab did more to provoke the Lord, Yahweh, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. That's quite a statement, isn't it? You get the introduction and they say, this guy was worse than any other king. Not only did he do all the things that got Jeroboam in trouble, but he did more than that. He went and he got for himself a pagan wife. He adopted her religion, and he made Baalism the state religion of the entire nation. He builds a temple for Baal. He builds an altar for Baal. He erects an Asherah, all sorts of wickedness. Remember, he is the most powerful king that will ever reign in the northern nation of Israel. That's the context that Elijah is called to speak the word of God into. A nation that's deeply committed to its idolatry, led by a king who's worse than all before him, is the most powerful king they'll ever see, and who is deeply committed to not just idolatry, but the worship of Baal in particular. And if all that's not bad enough, it's not like the Lord gave him some happy message to take to the king. Chapter 17. Now Elijah, the Tishbite of Tishbe in Gilead, said to Ahab, to the king, as the Lord, Yahweh, the God of Israel lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years, except by my word. Now remember, Israel is a fairly arid climate. They are quite dependent on the early and late rains of the rainy season to water their crops. They do not have any extensive irrigation system. This is not like the Nile, where it floods annually and there's a big floodplain and water goes everywhere and deposits nutrients and moisture, and it's pretty drought-proof most of the time. This isn't that. If you don't get rain, you don't get crops. And if you don't have crops, everybody dies. It's really that simple. So when Elijah shows up, looks the king in the face and says, Yahweh, the God of Israel, says, no more rain. Well, you can understand why the king is not very happy about this. This isn't a message anybody wants to hear. But you understand, right, that there is a deeper level to what he's saying. Remember, Ahab establishes Baal worship. Baal, in the Canaanite pantheon, is the storm god. Baal is the god who brings the rain, and if he brings the rain, then Baal is the god who brings life. So when Elijah shows up and names the name of the Lord and says, no, no, there won't be any more rain, he's creating a contest between the gods. And it becomes the context for all of the stories that follow. He's saying, you think it's Baal who brings life? We'll see about that. If he's really the god of life, then just have him make it rain. But I'm telling you, there will be no rain. In fact, it will be so dry in the land, there won't even be dew on the ground. So he's established a contest between the gods, but even more than that, Elijah has blasphemed Baal. He's spoken out against state-sanctioned religion. He's spoken out against the official worldview, the way things are, the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age. It's the way everybody perceives the world to be, including the king. This is how it is. And Elijah shows up and says, no, it ain't. The way you think it is a lie. And you have rejected the truth. Yahweh is God, not Baal. You understand, right? When you speak that sort of truth to that sort of power, you better be ready for power to clap back. In the very next verse, Yahweh is telling Elijah, go hide out in the desert. There's a wadi, a rain-fed stream that during the rainy season flows and in the dry season it doesn't. There's a wadi and you're going to go there and I'm going to take care of you and you're going to hide. Why? Because Ahab's going to kill him. You say something like that to the king is going to try and kill you. And what the story tells us is, in fact, that Ahab expended significant resources searching for Elijah, but he never found him. So Elijah goes out and he hides out by this stream and he drinks from it, and the Lord sends ravens to provide food for him. Till verse 7. And after a while, the brook dried up, because there was no rain in the land. We could just read over that verse as a simple statement of the facts, and it certainly is that. It's just a statement of the facts, but it's indicative of more, isn't it? I actually think this is the most significant verse in the whole passage in terms of making sense of what this passage might say to our own context. You see, if Yahweh is going to get into a competition with a false god, if he's going to demonstrate that he is God and the god of the prevailing worldview, the state-sanctioned god, is not God, well, guess what? Things are going to have to get worse before they get better. When the drought comes, it's not just a drought that affects the worshipers of Baal. No, no. It's a drought that affects everybody. Elijah included. I don't think there's any one-to-one correlation, but when I read about the cultural context that Elijah served in, I cannot help but notice a significant number of parallels with our own culture. Elijah lived in a culture where, not too far back in the distant memory, most people followed the Lord, but now no longer. Not too far back in the distant memory, prophets were on the same playing field as kings. And even when they weren't on the same playing field as kings, they were at least welcome members of the most important conversations. They were invited into the court, but that's not Elijah's context. No, he's now in the midst of a people who've gone far from the Lord. His value system is significantly at odds with their value system. I wonder if that's not true for us today. We remember a time where our culture seemed to share our values. And we remember a time where we were welcomed at the table of the most important conversations, but it seems that culture is moving further and further and further away, doesn't it? And for those of us who remember, and for those of us who still want to faithfully follow the Lord, and for those of us who'd see the rest of our neighbors faithfully follow the Lord, do we not cry out to God that He would just do something? Will you not, God, show up and show people that you are God? Won't you do some sign that can't be denied? Something like you did in days of old. Aren't we asking for Carmel? Mount Carmel. Not the candy. Chapter 18. After 3 years of drought, 3 years of no rain, finally the Lord comes to Elijah and says, go, show yourself to the king and call him out. And so he does, and he goes to the king, and he proposes a contest, or at least the conclusion of what's been a protracted contest. And he says, you bring your prophets, and I'll come alone, and we'll have a contest, and we'll find out who's God. And they agree to this, and they come, and they all gather on Mount Carmel. And he says, here's how we'll do it. You build an altar and sacrifice a bull. I'll build an altar and sacrifice a bull. Whichever God answers with fire from heaven, he is God. What do you say? Now, you notice throughout the whole story, Yahweh's pretty sporting about his competitions, isn't he? He always gives Baal home field advantage. He says, oh, okay, Baal's the rain god. Just have him make it rain. But I say no rain for 3 years. Baal's the god of the storm. Then a little lightning, a little fire from heaven shouldn't be a big deal. And the prophets of Baal seem to think the same thing. They say, sounds good to us. And so they build their altar and they sacrifice their bull and they start calling out to Baal. Oh, Baal, answer. Hello. Nothing happens. And this is where I love Elijah for this. This is where Elijah blesses my heart, because he's got a great sense of humor. They're calling out to Baal, and this is a religious service. Ain't nothing happening. So Elijah goes into telling jokes. Boys, how about you shout a little louder? Maybe he can't hear you. Maybe he's taking a nap. Maybe he's indisposed. Perhaps he went to the restroom. Maybe he'll come back. He says this in Hebrew. And they listen to him. It gets frantic. They begin to dance around and they shout louder and they begin to cut themselves. They think, maybe the blood of our sacrifice will get his attention. And it just devolves to utter chaos. And after this scene goes on for a little bit, Elijah says, all right. And he turns to the people of Israel. He says, come on over here. I'll show you a thing. And he rebuilds the altar of God and he sacrifices the bull. But that's not enough. He says, go get me some water. People are like, there's not a lot of water. Go get all the water. And he dumps copious amounts of water on something that's supposed to catch fire. And remember, water is like the most precious commodity. They don't have any of it. But he's just wasting it on the bull and on the wood. He digs a trench, fills it up. Then he prays. All right, God, show them. Fire falls. And it's consumed. All of it. The water, the trench, the altar, the bull, the wood, gone. And the people say, oh, Yahweh is God. Yahweh is God. Don't we want that? Is that not what we want in our day? Would a little fire from heaven in the midst of our cultural moment, wouldn't that be refreshing? But we forget that you only get to Carmel after 3 years of drought. You only get to Carmel when the king and all the people have gotten desperate enough to show up. It has to get a lot worse before it gets any better. I wonder if that's the moment we're in. And if what we need to recognize is that the getting worse before it gets better, it's not something that happens in spite of God's will. It is God's will. Because the contest didn't start on Carmel. It started in chapter 17, 3 years earlier. Just a brief aside to help us bring this home. Do you remember where Elijah shows back up in the story? I mean, after 1 and 2 Kings, where he makes a comeback? It's in the New Testament. It's in the Gospels, because in Judaism there arose this idea that before the Messiah would show up, first, Elijah would come again. And so as the disciples are starting to figure out that Jesus is the Messiah, they go to him and they say, isn't Elijah supposed to come? And Jesus says, oh, he does come. He came as John the Baptist, if you can accept that. But then he does actually show up. You remember? The Mount of Transfiguration, Jesus takes Peter, James, and John, and they go up, and it's almost like this reality is like torn back, and the disciples all of a sudden see Jesus as he really is, and he's like glowing, and it's incredible. And then two other individuals show up, Moses and Elijah, two of the greatest prophets from the Old Testament, and they talk to Jesus about his impending exodus, the crucifixion, and one of the ways that the church has talked about what Jesus did during his time on earth is we talk about the roles that he fulfilled, the roles he lived into. And so we talk about Jesus as prophet, priest, and king. And Jesus was a prophet. And like many of the prophets who went before him, he spoke truth to power, and he said out loud all the things nobody really wanted to hear. And when culture had veered off the right path, he said, y'all think it's this way, I'm telling you it's this way. Didn't make him very popular, at least not with people in positions of power. What I think we as the church must remember is that if Jesus Christ is the incarnation of God, if he is the Son of God and the Son of Man, God showing up in the flesh, joining himself to humanity, well, the church is the incarnation of Christ. We are his body, Paul tells us. His hands, his feet. The most significant way, I think, that Christ is present in the world is in and through his church. So what that means for us is that whatever it is Jesus did, we also must do. So if Jesus had a prophetic ministry and a prophetic role, you better believe the church has a prophetic ministry and a prophetic role. The only question for us is what sort of prophet? Because there was times in the history of the church where we were prophets in the way of Samuel. That is, we seemed as the church to be on par with the powers that be. There is the church and there is the state, and we were co-equal. And there have been times when the church has been like Nathan, where we weren't in power, but we were invited to the table. We got to speak into the most significant conversations, and we were a welcome part of that conversation. But I'm beginning to think that in our day, the church must be prophets in the way of Elijah. What that means is we're going to have to start saying out loud the things that people don't want to hear. And you had better believe when you speak that sort of truth to power and to a culture that's moving away, there's always a price to be paid. I know this is a really uplifting message, isn't it? We're going to get there. If that's true, can I just maybe prepare you for what you might experience? There's a theme repeated on the lips of Elijah throughout the course of this story over the many chapters you might have read this week. Maybe you caught it. Over and over again, he says, "And I alone stand before the Lord. I'm the only prophet left." Now, he's not actually reporting the facts, because even he knows that a man from the king's own court, Obadiah, has been actually hiding prophets in the cave and feeding them. And either Obadiah's got a lot of money or he's stealing the king's bread. I like to imagine it's the latter. It makes for a better story, I think. But you must understand, when you're embedded in a culture like ours that is constantly moving away from the sort of values and beliefs that Bible-believing Christians hold dear, it is an incredibly lonely experience. You will lose friends. You will lose influence. You may lose wealth and property. You may lose family members who are not willing to pay the sort of price you're willing to pay to hold the beliefs you're willing to hold. It is an incredibly lonely experience. But here's the good news. There's another theme that you get in every single one of these stories. Did you see it? It is the theme of the provision of God, beginning to end. Chapter 17, Elijah is forced into hiding, and ravens bring him bread. That's a miracle. Birds don't feed nobody. People feed birds. And that's silly too. Until God gets involved. And then miraculously, you eat. And when you begin to experience the consequences of the hand of God working in a culture, and it seems like everything's getting worse, and you find that the stream you were dependent on dries up, well, then God sends Elijah somewhere else. And he finds a widow, and the widow has nothing. And how can a widow with nothing provide? Well, she doesn't, but God does, and the oil does not run out, and the flour does not run out until the rain of God returns. And God provides. And when Jezebel was killing the prophets, a man from her own court, an insider who's a part of the system, saves the ones he can. And he hides them away. And when everybody's struggling for food, somehow he figures out how to feed 100 men. How do you move food for 100 prophets and nobody notices? The provision of God. And when you are persona non grata, and people are even afraid to talk about you because they think the king will kill them just for talking about you, and God says, go show yourself to the king. He's protected. Because if I'm Ahab, and Elijah comes out and says, hey, let's have a contest between your prophets and mine, I'm thinking, I've got a better idea. Guards, kill him now. But that doesn't happen. And when Elijah puts himself really out there, I mean, if you're going to say that God is going to bring fire from heaven and you've just dumped water on your sacrifice, like, you had better hope God shows up. There's no faking that. And you're going to look like a real fool if God doesn't show up. But he does. God provides the fire from heaven when it was necessary. And when Jezebel is angry that all of her prophets have been taken down into the valley and killed off, and Ezekiel fears for his life, and most scholars believe he's trying to abandon his ministry, he leaves Israel. He leaves the country, and he flees all the way through Judah down to Beersheba, which is the southernmost city, and then he leaves his servant there, and by himself he goes off into the wilderness, and he's like, I've had enough. That's a pretty good translation of the Hebrew. Enough, God! I'm done! Let me die. Because I'm tired of this. Tired of the hiding out. I'm tired of being alone. Tired of running for my life. It doesn't seem to change anything. I'm tired. It's enough. God sends his angel. And he wakes Elijah up. Food. Miraculously. In the wilderness. And Elijah goes back to sleep. So again, the angel comes, he wakes him up, and there's food again, and he says, listen, Elijah, you've had enough. The path God has set your feet on is more than enough. You don't have what it takes to obey God's will for your life. So eat and drink. And the food's enough to sustain him on a 30-day journey to Mount Sinai, where Elijah confronts God with all of his complaints. And God doesn't really address him. He kind of sidesteps him and says, look, man, you're off mission. I gave you a job to do. Now I'm going to expand it. Here's some other things I want you to do, but listen, you're not alone in this fight. I've been with you the whole time. I've provided for you the whole time, but even if that were not enough, there are 7,000 in Israel. You don't know their names. Most of them keep pretty quiet. It seems like they're in hiding, but there are 7,000 who have not bowed their knee to Baal. And I will give you Elisha. Go, anoint him to be prophet, and he'll be with you, and then when you're gone, he'll carry on the work. God provides. Whatever you need, I didn't say want, whatever it is you need to do what God has called you to do, he'll provide. I didn't say it'd be easy, but he'll provide. I do believe, I might be wrong, but I do believe that in our country we are approaching a moment of reckoning. A moment of reckoning where there will no longer be any space for nominal Christianity. It'll cost you too much to not be all in or all out. And we're going to have to make a decision. Are we going to be the sort of people that say the sort of things that nobody wants to hear? because it's true? Or do we just go along to get along? It will cost us something. But I believe that is the prophetic sort of ministry that God is calling his church to. It's interesting, the song we sang this morning. Did you notice? Karen picks great songs. Me and Karen never talk about my sermon, by the way. If like the songs and the sermon line up, like that's a God thing. Like we never talk about what I'm preaching. I never tell her. This is the first few lines of the one song we sang this morning. These are the days of Elijah, declaring the word of the Lord. And these are the days of your servant Moses, the righteousness being restored. I hope you heard this line, though. And I wonder if you meant it when you sang it. And though these are days of great trial, of famine and darkness and sword, still we are the voice in the desert crying, prepare you the way of the Lord. That last line is from the prophet Isaiah, and it was spoken about John the Baptist, who prepared the way for the Lord Jesus, who served in the role of Elijah, who happened to be with Moses on the Mount of Transfiguration. You see how all of this comes together? There's a lot more in the songs than maybe you noticed. But do you believe that this morning? I do. I'm not saying you have to. I'm just telling you what I think. I think these are the days of Elijah. Days of trial, famine, darkness, sword. And I do think it'll get worse before it gets better. But it's not a sign that God has abandoned us. It's a sign that he's working. It's a sign that he's working. And the one thing I do know in an uncertain future, the thing I hold on to this morning, is that God always provides. Whatever he calls you into, he provides for. We must remember that as we make the decisions about what sort of church, what sort of people we want to be. Will we be prophets? I hope so. And we can, because he provides. Amen.